Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let me start with some Major League Baseball. So Major League Baseball has developed a 67-page health and safety document that outlines the steps that would be involved if they're going to be able to safely return to baseball. Perhaps you've seen this. It is really detailed, and it should be. And some of the details are extremely detailed. Let me give you some of the basics. Players would need to undergo multiple temperature checks each day, starting at home or the hotel before they leave for the stadium. They would also receive multiple COVID tests per week. Each team would be allowed to have 50 players, with some number lower than that active for each game, although the official number still has not been worked out. Then you've got players and team personnel who are not playing in the game would have to sit in the stands, which is not a problem because there are no fans. But they'd have to be separated by 6 feet, at least 6 feet. Here's where it gets interesting. Base coaches at first and third are not allowed to approach base runners or the umpires. Players should not interact with opponents. And according to Jeff Passan, fielders will be, quote, encouraged to retreat several steps away from the base runner, end quote, between pitches. I could go on, but here is John Heyman with a summary. Quote, out or discouraged in proposed MLB protocols, spitting, seeds, tobacco, licking fingers, fighting, hitting inside, meeting inside, bat boys, high fives, fist bumps, fraternizing, showers, sauna, hydrotherapy, Uber, subway, leaving the hotel. End of quote. In other words, my 14-year-old kid would be great. He'd love that life. Heyman says the ban on licking fingers, hitting inside, high fives, hydrotherapy, and leaving the hotel would be the toughest ones, according to players and coaches. He then followed that up with another tweet. Quote, give MLB credit for exhaustive list of protocols. Also out, exchanging lineup cards, sitting close in dugout, touching face while giving signs. But after seeing the list, a few baseball folks wondered if, one, it's not as safe as they thought, two, impractical and not doable, and three, even worth it, end quote. Got to agree there. I mean, you have to have a really detailed and comprehensive plan if you're even going to consider starting the season at this point. But when you have a plan that is that detailed and that comprehensive, it's going to come with questions. And when you see it spelled out like that, yeah, I could see where baseball folks are wondering if it's even worth it. When you see all the things that are going to be banned or discouraged, it feels like it's going to be a totally different game. It feels like it might not be doable. Pretty sure the game, for instance, would be the same even without high fives and fist bumps. And honestly, while I do hate to take any food off of the bat boys' tables, I'm pretty sure the pros can pick up their own bats. But good luck convincing these same pros that they have to leave the field after the game and go home or go to the hotel without a shower. And in terms of the game, base coaches can't approach base runners. Fielders are encouraged to back away from the runner between pitches. So you can't hold a runner on first base? Or is this just going to be a base-stealing free-for-all? And the ban on licking fingers. I mean, that seems kind of weird, right? Until you watch a game and notice how many pitchers lick their fingers, most of them. And how about that restriction on fighting? It took a global health crisis for the league to say, hey, y'all can't fight. Knock it off with the fighting. Does that mean that throwing inside is going to be banned as well? Because why the hell wouldn't a pitcher come inside if he knows the batter is not allowed to charge the mound? Then again, is there really any way to keep a guy from charging the mound if he feels like his livelihood or even his life has been threatened? And then there's that whole thing about leaving the hotel. You're not allowed to leave the hotel. I mean, that's wild, right? You go to the park. You can't hit inside before the game. You play the game. You cannot shower. You take a team bus back to the hotel, and then you're locked in for the rest of the night and the following day. Go ask Mike Jordan what it was like to hole up in his hotel room for weeks and months on end. And I'd be willing to bet that certain guys are going to be really aggro when it comes to that one restriction in particular, the one relating to tobacco and spitting. You're telling me I can't dip. You're telling me I can't spit. You know Team Dip is going to lose their mind over that. I can't shower after playing a major league game. All right, fine. Cool. But no chaw? No dipping? Man, now you're going too far. Listen, when you asked me not to see my family for 4 months, I was fine with that. But no spitting? No dipping? Are you kidding me? I'm picking my cope over my fam every day of the week. I'm addicted to my tin, not my wife or my kids. Come on, man. The hell you think I play the game for? I play the game for the love of the game, but mostly for the love of the dip. How much of our salaries do we have to give back in order to be allowed to dip? How much? Tell me. I'll scratch you a check right now to cover all my dip fines. Better yet, how about this? How about we play for free, but you pay us in skull and cope? Because you know there are some guys who, if you made them choose between their jobs and their dip, they're taking the dip every single time. Fact is, some of these guys can't play without it. Yeah, I said it. They can't play without it. Some of these guys can't live without it. I can't wait until players show up picketing and protesting at the yard that their constitutional dipping rights have been violated. But it does raise the question, right? If you have to do all of these things in order to make it safe as possible, how safe is it really? If you have to have your temperature checked multiple times per day and have a COVID test multiple times per week, and you can't sit next to your teammates in the dugout, and the base coaches can't touch their faces in order to give signs, the players can't talk to the opposition, they can't take showers after games, they can't dip, does it even make sense to try? Does it even make sense to play? Again, fraternizing with the opposition does not make or break the game, but when the league feels like that's an important step for safety, it does make you wonder how safe it really is. Don't get me wrong, I really want to see baseball return. I really want to see society freaking return. I do. I want to see all sports return. Except I want to see it done safely. And if guys are not showering after the games and they've got to go back to the hotel and sit in their rooms for 18 or so hours straight when they're not at the stadium, is it really safe enough to return? And better yet, is it really worth it? Especially if you're not allowed to dip or fight. What's baseball without dipping and fighting? Good luck selling that. You know, these guys are like, wait, what?
No!
No cope? No dip? No chaw?
No!
Not even any red man? Oh, hell no. And good luck trying to ban fighting when a guy's dealing with those nicotine fits. This guy's up there, he hasn't dipped in a few weeks. And some pitcher comes inside. Oh, yeah, he's not going to fight. Yeah, my man's going to the mound with the bat. Herm Edwards joins us once again. Herman, it's great to have you back. And before we talk about anything else, how are you and everybody around you doing as we go through this really unusual time, Herm?
We are good. We are trying to get comfortable with the normal. Wearing a mask and social distancing. Problem is, the sport that I coach and I've been involved in my whole life, there's no such thing as social distancing, so we're trying to figure that out.
Yeah, well, that's such a good point, and I want to get to that in just 1 minute. And let me ask you this. A few weeks back, I thought you made a really interesting point when you said, quote, when you think about our world, we live in a noisy world. It's very quiet now. We're not used to quiet, and I think when quiet comes, we got to reflect on our lives and be thankful for the days that we're here, end quote. It's a powerful statement. How have you gone about embracing the quiet time, and what have you learned during that time?
Well, what I learned is, you know, when you reflect on yourself and you think about the journey of your life, everyone goes on a journey, and there's certain points in your life that you always remember that were significant. And I think this will be a significant moment in everyone's life as far as how you handle it. And I think for me as well, I mean, you know, I've had some catastrophic things happen that I've been a part of. I can remember losing my dad after my first year in the league. I can remember the 9/11 situation when I was the head coach of the Jets. Now all of a sudden this situation appears. So there's always some situations in your life that you could reflect on and say, after that moment, what happened, right? And I think that's how I'm kind of looking at this. You know, what is football going to look like? How do you coach football now with a sport that has so much energy involved with the players and the camaraderie and that fellowship you have? How can you have that now in a football setting? And I think every coach is wrestling with that, to be quite honest.
Capital One knows life does not alert you about your credit card. Hey, couch surfers. We've got nonstop tunes to keep you rocking while you work. Oh, and Colleen. Yes, you, Colleen with a K. Your free trial of Movie Plus ends tomorrow, and your card may be charged. Do you want to continue or do you want to cancel? Sweet. So, meet Eno, the Capital One assistant. Eno looks out for surprise charges, like when free trials expire, and helps you if you need to fix them. Eno, another way Capital One is watching out for your money when you are not. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Limitations apply. Herm Edwards joining us. You know, Herm, to your point, you've been through a lot of things in your life, some catastrophic things. You've got that experience, but you're dealing with a lot of young, young players. You've got a lot of young talent in that program right now, but they're young, and they're going through something that, frankly, none of us have ever dealt with. So what has been the message to your players during this spring?
Well, I think the thing is that, you know, when we think about team, it's always about your teammates. And basically, we're all on the same team now. You've got more than just the teammates here at ASU. It's got the people in your community. And I tell them this. This is about protecting your family members, guys. And I told them that when we first left, Jim. I said, you know what? This is not about you guys so much. It's about grandma, grandpa, about your mom, your dad, all those people that have raised you, that have influenced you in your life. Now you got to help them by the decisions you make off the field of play, who you socialize with, what you do, the precautions of all the things that are necessary now to make sure those people around you stay healthy.
Arizona State head football coach Herm Edwards is joining us. I know I have similar conversations with my two kids who are teenagers. Now, Herm, one of the things you've talked about is the fact that you've been able to recruit players who fit your DNA. How would you define your DNA? What are you looking for in a player when you recruit?
Well, first of all, you know, football is a funny game. Sports is funny. Are they interested or are they committed? Most people are interested. And I say that in this sense. They're interested in the fact that if I'm getting something out of it, I'm good. But when it gets hard, I'm not quite sure if I want to commit to this. You know, interest is when it's convenient. When you commit to something, there's no excuses. It gets hard. And the commitment of football is the preparation of it all. It's easy to play in the game. It's all the other stuff you have to do before you even get to the game. Do you want to do that? The preparation part. I like guys that like preparing. I like guys that are in search of knowledge. You know, no coach in the history of coaching any sport has ever given a player talent, by the way. God gives them talent. You give them knowledge. What guys are hungry for knowledge when they walk in the building?
That's gold. I love that. Are you interested or are you committed? Now, the other thing, Herm, that you've done is you've assembled an amazing staff, including my guy, Marvin Lewis. Marvin Lewis, Herm, could be doing any number of things right now. What's it say about him and about the program that you're building that he's the co-defensive coordinator?
Well, we go way back now. Over 30 years, Marvin and myself, and, you know, he had bought a home here quite some time when he was with Cincinnati. He would leave in the summer, and when he got out, he was here, and, you know, I told him, I said, you're going to get tired playing golf. I said, you need to come over here and just, you know, be a consultant. So he was a consultant last year, and then Danny Gonzalez gets an opportunity to be a head coach, and he walks into my office, and he goes, I'll do it. And I looked at him and said, do what? He said, I'll do it for you. And I said, okay, that's what you're saying. But let me go ask Peggy, your wife, if it's okay with her.
Right. Hey, Herm, did you say Marvin, are you interested or are you committed, Marvin?
Yeah, he's committed. He is all in. I mean, he is all in. He is so happy coaching. And it's like anything else. I mean, when I was on television, you know, and I was away from it, that Under Armour thing, that Under Armour game I was coaching, those high school players.
Sure.
I can remember after about the second year, I told my wife, I said, you know, I said, I'm kind of. She said, don't start. I said, I don't know.
Don't start.
It just sucks you in, Jim. It just sucks you back in, man.
Don't start. You know, it's not Herm Edwards is my guest. Herm, it's not just Lewis, too. You have Antonio Pierce, another guy that I love talking to back in the day. He is the other co-defense coordinator, killing it in recruiting. Your recruiting classes have gotten better every single year since you've been there. There's a ton of buzz and energy around the program. It's a program that has been building since you arrived. Does it feel like you're ready to take a big step?
We're getting close, and we're very young, Jim. I'm glad you mentioned that because the staff really does a great job of really defining our DNA and going to search for players that meet that. With that being said, there's only 7 seniors on this team. It's young. We're really young, which is kind of good.
Sure.
And we got a young quarterback.
I was going to ask you about that quarterback. When you and I spoke last season, we talked about your quarterback, Jaden Daniels, and what he could do. When we talked during the season, we talked about Jaden Daniels and what he was doing. Now that he's got that year under his belt, to your point, Herm, he's young, but how special can he be?
Well, he can be. And, you know, he can't do it by itself. We got to help him. And I think we've gone out and got him some players that can play on the perimeter. We brought in some running backs in here that we feel that can carry the load as well. So we're starting to build the offense around him. And I think that's what you got to do. You know, there's systems and all that stuff. I always said this. The system is the quarterback. Build it around what the quarterback needs. We got Zach Hill here now, our new offensive coordinator. He's got a great mind of trying to do things offensively, multidimensional, a lot of different formations, a lot of personnel groups. Has a quarterback now that can do some things from the line of scrimmage. He can get out of some plays into some ones that he likes. So we're excited about what we're trying to do.
Herm Edwards joins me for a couple of more moments. Herm, you had this great pic on Twitter the other day, and it was a photo of you from your playing days in Philadelphia matched up with Brandon Ayuk, who was just drafted by the 49ers. So how do you think that matchup might go? Would you have locked him up?
He has no chance. I told him he was having a nightmare. When he said he could catch the ball on me, he said, wake up, son, you're having a nightmare.
Right.
Go back to sleep. I tell you what, he's a talented player. He really is, and I'm really happy for the guy because he came in as a JC guy and really worked his tail off and kind of interesting. You know, last 2 years we've had 2 receivers drafted in the first round. So we're starting to get those kind of guys, which is important. That always helps your program.
So really quickly, how do you think that he'll do in that system in San Francisco? How do you like that fit between him and Kyle Shanahan's offense? Does that feel like a good match between a player and a team?
It does. And, you know, John Lynch is a good friend. You know that. I mean, you know how far me and John go back. And I just think the matchup, which Coach Shanahan, he always seems to create on offense, gets the one-on-one matchups. Brandon can play in the slot, and he's also a return guy. And that's what he does. When he gets the ball in his hand, he's very explosive. So it'll be kind of fun to watch him play in that offense.
Herm, you and John go so far back. Are you in any way surprised at the success he's had in his role as general manager with the 49ers?
No. And all the way through this, I mean, we're in constant communication. The Lynch family and ourselves, you know, he, obviously we're the godparents of Leah, their daughter, and John and Linda, the godparents of our son, Marcus. So we struck a relationship when I went to Tampa, and it grew and it's grown since then. I mean, we're a very tight family together. We discuss a lot of things. But when John took that job, I understood the mindset. I knew what he was trying to do, him and Kyle. You could see he was building up the offensive line and the defensive line. And then from there, you know, going to go out and get players, and then you get a quarterback in there. Now they got a system. They got a way to define their DNA. They're going to be a good football team for a long time.
So finally, Herm, I got to ask the question. Like, with the success you've had in college and your track record also in the NFL, it would not be surprising if an NFL team or teams were to call you about a head coaching job. If the phone rings, do you owe it to yourself to answer, or are you in a really good place right now?
I'm in a really good place, and I'm going to give them some candidates when they call me, and it won't be me.
There you go.
This is my last job, partner. You're going to be talking to me the next 5 years. This is my last job.
I love it. I love it, and I will be, too. He is the – you just heard it right there. Arizona State head football coach Herm Edwards doing a great job there and having a great time. Herm, I really appreciate you. I know you get this phone call quite a bit, and I'm glad you said yes to me and to the program. It's always good to have you on the show, and you know I appreciate the relationship.
Thank you, brother.
Today I've got another player profile. Today we focus on the weirdest caller maybe in Jungle history. I'm going to argue the most unique, the most different. And you've heard me say it. Generally, I think that weird is good. In this case, to me, weird is great. If I'm talking about the weirdest caller in Jungle history, then you know I'm talking about Jeff in Southfield. Jeff, having any title in the Jungle is amazing in and of itself, considering he's only been calling the show since July of 2018. Not even 2 years. But in less than 2 years, he's carved out a space like nobody before him. And it all started with that very first call, that first vine that he grabbed less than 2 years ago when he made what I would consider the best first call, the best debut call to this program ever.
Hey, Mike and Indy, in your smack-off call, you dub yourself the undisputed silverback of the Jungle. Who you kidding, fool? We all know the accurate color of your back is extra pale, pasty white. Your back is whiter than Jeff Van Gundy's ghost. And your neck is redder than Caleb's face when his parents bust into his room and catch him getting excited about Boston chicken. Remember, Rachel shaved your back. It turns out Rachel didn't shave her back. She shaved off the first two letters of her name and became Chael the MMA fighter. Sorry, Mike, that bromance you thought you were having is really just an ugly chick. You know who I'm not going to crack at, Jim? Henry Winkler. Jim, Fonzie is the first clone ever. He was a clone before you were even born. The character Fonzie on Happy Days was an adult male, aged somewhere between 30 and 45, not married, no kids, and living in the spare bedroom of a suburban family's home. Now that's a clone if ever there was one, Jim. I wonder if Fonz's full name was Arthur Caleb Fonzarelli. Jim, while my respect for the Fonz as a clone has skyrocketed, my respect for the notion of the TV character Fonzie as a ladies' man has plummeted. No wonder he never got a second date with Pinky Tuscadero. Turns out his hopes of scoring with her got Malachi crunched between two realities. One, he doesn't have enough money to take her anywhere better than Arnold's. And two, the bed he wanted to take her to is in the spare bedroom of Mr. and Mrs. Cunningham's house.
I gotta wonder about this guy. Like, when this guy went to make that call, I wonder if he knew that I would think as highly of that call as I do, or if he was going to flame immediately and get run because nobody would understand where the hell he was coming from. Luckily, I got it right away. Immediately during that call, I immediately started to think, who the hell is this cat? Where the hell did he come from? What did he just say? Like, from that very moment, Jeff in Southfield became a household Jungle name because he has checked in time and time again and taken some of the most bizarre runs ever heard on this show, including that time he cracked back on Gino in San Antonio for all the shots that Gino had taken at Detroit. And if you have not heard architecture smack and line dancing smack on this show, you are about to.
Hey, Gino in San Antonio. Detroit's entire skyline is iconic buildings by renowned architects like Albert Kahn, Ort Rowland, and Lewis Camper. San Antonio has one iconic building, the Alamo, which looks like it was designed by the architectural team from Taco Bell. San Antonio has less soul than a country western bar. Hey, country western bar, you need to rename your dance floor the We're Too Stiff to Dance Floor, since all I see you doing on it is walking. I see you walking forward 5 steps, walking backward 5 steps, and walking sideways 5 steps. Hey, cowboy, in Detroit, walking ain't dancing. I wasn't sure why the women of country western bars put up with that crap until I figured out what the cowboy hat really is. Turns out the cowboy hat is just a visual distraction that cowboy uses so cowboy's woman won't look down and notice cowboy can't dance.
Holy crap. Like, you have a problem with that, you got a problem with you. Cowboy. The only reason cowboy wears cowboy hat is so cowboy woman can't look down and realize that cowboy can't dance. The cowboy's walking. Like, when it's better in playback or it's better than you remember it, it's good. So since he showed up, architecture smack, line dancing smack, cowboy smack, Fonzarelli smack. And since this all started, there have been a couple of common refrains, common takes about him from the rest of the clones. Either he's a Mike and Indy character or doing a Mike and Indy character, despite the fact that he took a run at him in his very first call. Either he's doing Mike and Indy or he's doing Mitch Hedberg. Personally, I don't think either are true. But both takes are rooted in this notion that that's somebody doing an impression of somebody else. Which is ironic, because Jeff in Southfield has made a name for himself by doing impressions. But he's out there in broad daylight doing it as an impression and not trying to be somebody else or not trying to rip something else off. He does impressions from John in New York to Grant Napier to Trapper to Matt in L.A. to Cal in Vegas as well.
Jim, I went to the internet, Jim, and your podcasts are awesome.
Whatever, four-time Smack-Off winner, I'm a 40-time guest host, and I have my own show. Ooh, you won $5,000? I make $5,000 every time someone dunks at a Kings game. Hey, Brad, the reason my gorgeous wife is with me and not you is because I'm a good-hearted fellow. Hang up the phone and go listen to Jesse's Girl by Rick Springfield, Brad, because I'm Jesse, and you're just wishing, you loser.
Another great thing about Old Trapper is it won't cost you 30 pieces of silver, babe. You can have it for as little as an irate Craig royalty check. Tramps like us, babe.
Yo, Romeo, from reaching over trays and cell block D to my job cleaning trays at Mickey D's, you're welcome.
Hey, Mom, I'm tired of you favoring my sister. You better buy me that toy I want. I'll meet you in the basement, rip that makeup off your face, and make you eat it.
I'm telling you, this dude. Like, you never know what you're going to get with Jeff. You just know it's going to be weird. And it's going to be original. And I'm here for all of it.
I'm not saying Big Daddy B-Cups is overweight. I'm just saying if Beaks was in the rock band Led Zeppelin, their hit song Stairway to Heaven would be titled Stairway Too Difficult. I've been watching how Keith does his job, and I believe I am qualified to be his replacement. Much like Keith, I can stand with my hands in my pockets doing nothing. Like Keith, I can make business casual clothing look like I'm wearing sweats. And like Keith, I am talented enough to push a print button and carry a piece of paper from one room to another.
Hey, Cal in Vegas, remember these words. The reason gamblers say winner, winner, chicken dinner is because gamblers don't win enough to eat steak. When your side salad has a Mount Everest of bacon bits on it, you've broken your diet. Do what you really want to do and dump out that lettuce and put that mountain of bacon bits on top of a bowl of nacho cheese covered taco meat, you sick pig.
Hey, Cal, you can think Las Vegas is classy and glamorous. I think Las Vegas is what happens when that place Robert Kraft went to puts blackjack tables in its lobby.
Hey, Jeff, I believe you can afford luxury sleds and Armani suits when I see some evidence that you can afford Bluetooth.
And I don't want to hear how Green Bay is like a college town. How is Green Bay like a college town? Let's see. You've replaced the cap and gown with a cheese hat and snow parka. You've replaced professors with plant managers. You've replaced students with plant workers. And you've replaced classrooms and books with break rooms and porno mags. The only way that's like a college town is if we're talking about Ohio State.
Hey, Wisconsin, you need to change your motto on Wisconsin to on our way to diabetes, Wisconsin, since you are.
I'm a starving tiger for the title King of Smack.
I don't know who I'm more impressed with, him or Alvin. Look at the XR4TI earning their stripes, earning their paychecks, doing this guy right. And the most amazing thing is, when you listen back to that, hey, by the way, bravo, crew. I don't know if I've ever given the guys on the other side of the glass, I'm not including you in that writ. You had nothing to do with it. That's just for the front row right there. That's Hawk and Avi doing Jeff right. When you hear that, that's an amazing profile. When you hear that, though, hard to imagine two things. Hard to imagine that last year was only Jeff and Southfield's first Smack-Off. That rip that I just played would be a good jungle career for anybody else not named Brad. That guy's done all of that in less than 2 years. And amazingly enough, despite all of that, that was his first Smack-Off. And maybe even more surprising is the fact that he did not finish in the top 10. That might have been the most surprising plot twist of Smack-Off 25. Jeff went on for 5 minutes and finished out of the top 10. And I think for those 5 minutes, he was kind of out of rhythm on the big stage. That'll happen. It's the main event. That was his first rep. That was his first big cut. Calling on that day is a lot different than calling on any other normal day. But I don't doubt for a second. He'll be back, and he'll be back ready to go. He'll be back on the 19th. I fully expect him to have a much, much, much better showing in his sophomore effort. Because those calls that I played back, those regular season calls, those normal day calls, any of those would probably have been better, Maybe not any of them, but a lot of them would have been better than what we saw on Smackoff Day. So I know he's got it in him. This dude's got a gear and a skill set that I haven't seen. Not better, but different. And sometimes different is better. So now he's got that experience of that maiden voyage under his belt. Not every great horse wins first time out. Not every great horse hits the board first time out. There have been some Hall of Fame horses that finished out of the money first time out. They need the race. They need the experience. They need some of that mud kicked up in their face. Stucknut has got him going off at 9-1. Let me tell you something. If I were a betting man, I'd hit that. That'd be one of the plays. And I don't want to color that because I'm the guy that makes the decision. But I'm just saying, if I were somebody looking to get down and I was not a part of the decision-making process and I heard what I just heard, in fact, I wonder, I don't know about Stucknut. I don't know how those things are affecting the odds. Generally, the odds are affected by the money that comes in. But if I just played what I played and I heard what I just played, that number has to be affected. That number should not still be 9-1 based on what we just did on the program. I'm not sure how that affects the odds on Stucknut. But 9-1 for that guy? Good value. He is Charlie Hoffman. Charlie, it's so good to have you back. You know, it's been less than 4 months since you and I sat down at the Farmers Insurance Open down in San Diego, and a lot's changed since then. How have you and your family been doing in the middle of this pandemic?
It's been very interesting, to say the least. You know what? I went from getting ready for one of our major championships, the Players' Championship in Ponte Vedra, to becoming a first and third grade teacher in all of a matter of a week. I wasn't quite prepared for that.
Man, that is the truth. I was going to say, so like, what's a normal day like? You kind of answered this in part, but what's a normal day like? Have you taken over as teacher, and are you doing the homeschooling, or are you trying to avoid that?
You know, at the first 6 to 8 weeks, I thought it was fun to do all that stuff and try to educate my kids. And you know what? The last couple of weeks, it's been nice to see the end somewhat in the near future for me, because I have rescinded my duty as teacher to my wife to cover all subjects, and I'm back to work again. So, you know what? The first few weeks, obviously being on the road for my whole life, never being home for more than a couple of weeks at a time, it was great to spend that time with the family and do all that stuff. But from a guy that traveled his whole life, I'm looking forward to getting back on the road. There's no question.
Charlie Hoffman's joining us. Now, this part of the conversation is not a promotional pitch. It just is what it is. My Peloton has kept me sane. I got on yesterday, and it said you've got a 10-week streak going, and that felt pretty good. I know you've been hitting yours as well. How's that been going for you?
You know what? Yeah, it started at the beginning of the quarantine. It was sort of something to do. I'm blessed and lucky enough to have a Peloton at home and a home gym and able to stay active. And Peloton is one of those ways to get your competitive juices out. Billy Horschel, started rounding a few people up with Rory and Justin Thomas and Ricky Fowler and Bubba Watson jumped on, and it sort of became competitive. We want to kick each other's butt on the golf course, but not only are we competitive there, we're competitive when we work out. And you know what? Unfortunately, Rory's number one in the world on the golf course, and I can't keep up with him on the Peloton either. I can get close, but I can't beat him.
I was going to say, how do I get into that group? But I'm not saying that because I don't want any part of that group. What kind of rides do you do? How long?
Lee, I'm a shorter guy. I'm more like a 30-minute guy. When I first got the Peloton, it was more like a 15-minute, 20-minute warm-up before I'd hit the gym, just sort of get the body going. And now it's taken over to a 30 or 45 minute ride and going pretty hard and then hitting the gym after that. So, you know what? It's been fun to take part of that Peloton world. And you know what? Their content's great. There's a reason why they're making money and people buy them, because you know what? They put a good content out and it keeps you motivated and going.
Charlie, I'll mention it. I bought mine, and I feel like you. I feel very lucky to be able to have one, but I bought mine long before we did any business with them. I love the product. I think it's a great, great model. What's really interesting is I'll go 45 minutes, and I go as hard as I possibly can, and I feel like I'm in pretty good cardio shape. Man, it's demoralizing only in the sense that I feel good about me until I look at that leaderboard. There are some people that are really, really good, really motivated, and really in shape, right?
It's insane how fast some of these guys can go and see numbers.
And gals.
I mean, it's I mean, I go, like, I put the heart rate monitor machine, I'm at the 100% max majority of the time. I don't know what they want me to do. I'm 43 years old.
Right. And a pro athlete.
I mean, somewhat of an athlete, but I mean, let's not get carried away here. But you know what? I've really enjoyed it. I think I've gotten in better shape because I've stayed a little more consistent with that cardiovascular. But, you know, we're always in pretty decent shape. We're on our feet for 6 hours at a time, but because of the burst and those hills and that Peloton gives us, I mean, it's fun. And I'm going to miss it because our gym's going to be closed back on the road when we get back out there. We're not going to open our gym up. They used to have two Peloton bikes on our trailer that's a gym, and we're going to keep that closed for safety reasons. So I'm going to miss it once I get back on the road.
I appreciate your thoughts on that. Charlie Hoffman's joining us. Now, you mentioned this, but you finished tied for ninth at the Farmers, and then you skipped ahead to March, or I will, and you had a top 15 at Bay Hill the week before the Players, and then you were 2-under on the first round at the Players Championship. Then the tournament was called. You were playing really well. So what was that entire experience like for you?
Yeah, you know what? It's surreal just even still looking back at it. It's one of those, obviously, people started catching other sports and it became real. And I was on the call with Jay Monahan on Thursday night after the round, and we were talking about what should we do. And I was under the impression of everybody's here. Why don't we just keep going? Obviously we were going to stop the fans after Thursday. You know what? Jay made the right decision. He sort of went off of his own. I know the players wanted to keep going because we're athletes and we love to compete under any circumstances. Obviously, safety's first and foremost, but we were all there and ready to go. And he made the right call to get us out and so we can get home and be safe before. I mean, we didn't know if there was going to be a travel ban. We have been, obviously, a third of our membership's international. They may want to go home before the international travel ban hit. So, there was a lot of smart decisions Jay has made throughout this process, and that was one of them.
Charlie Hoffman joining us. Now, you said that you didn't touch a club for 6 weeks after the Players' Championship. Why was that? Was that a conscious decision, or did that just kind of happen?
You know, I knew I needed to take some time off because starting in June, when we went back again with all these major championships being rescheduled, but the winter months were going to be heavy months for me, and those are months usually – a professional golfer takes light. So I knew I needed to take that time off to let my body rest, recover, get stronger during that time. And obviously the back, we're not a contact sport, but our back gets pretty tweaked up swinging the golf club at 120 miles an hour as hard as we can. And, you know, it was a conscious decision to take that time off. And so I could be able to, my body would be ready to ramp up in the winter.
So then what was it like when you opened the bag back up and you teed it up again for the first time? Was there any rust, or were you able to pick up right where you left off?
You know, obviously there was a little bit of rust, but I tried to go true country club or a normal muni guy. I went straight from the car to the first tee. And you know what? I'm not very good at that when I'm playing a lot of golf. So it was interesting to say the least, but I actually played better than I anticipated. I probably shot 1 or 2 under, and I only played 9 holes the first time I came back. And hit some decent shots, and the power wasn't there because he hadn't been swinging the golf club. The efficiency, I'd say, wasn't there. But you know what? It was more than anything, just like anybody else, it was nice to get out of the house, breathe some fresh air, and just walk around the golf course. The first time I played, it was before technically the courses were open. There's no holes in the course. And we just sort of a couple of buddies just went and walked around, took the bag on the shoulders, walked around, put a water ball down the green, and if it hit the water ball, it counted as a putt made. And it was actually quite fun. And you sort of, after 6 weeks of not playing, you sort of lose how much fun you actually have on the golf course, how much banter you can have, and just walking around with a few buddies and enjoying a good time.
Charlie Hoffman joining us. I don't know, Charlie, it seems to me like I wish this had not happened, honestly, but there's no way that we could ever have the appreciation and the perspective that we have for everything, our jobs, our lives, our families, our relationships, without going through something like this. And I would imagine maybe even the sport that you love, you feel that way about. You mentioned Jay Monahan, PGA Tour Commissioner. I'm curious, you're the chairman of the Players Advisory Council. What's it been like being in that role during this time?
Boy, it's been a role that I don't think any of us as players or player directors or chairmen were ready for. Our forte is to go out and get the ball in the hole faster than most. And I don't know if we're groomed to make all these important decisions, but our board and our commissioner and their staff has done an amazing job of first strategically coming up with a plan that we need to do and follow through with. And just we've been on tons of phone calls week in and week out, just coming up. Because obviously, as I tell people, there's no formula for this. No one's gone through this before. I mean, we've hired the best in the world sort of guide us through this from the infectious disease side to following the World Health Organization, the CDC. And, you know, we're making all the proper moves, making all the right decisions. Obviously, we were going to get back to competition here soon, but first and foremost, we want the safety of our players and our fans before we make any major decisions. But you know what? It's been fun to be on all these calls and just sort of see how the whole process works. And obviously, I know a lot more about the PGA Tour business than I ever did 9 weeks ago. So it's nice to know the ins and outs and where we're at. And I know for a fact, I knew before that we had great leadership, but there's no doubt in my mind now that we do.
Charlie Hoffman, my guest. Before I let you go, I want to ask you, I don't know that you and I have ever talked about this before. As people know, your nickname is the Seagull. For those who do not know the origin of the nickname, Charlie, why are you called the Seagull?
You know what? Seagulls are a native bird of the Southern California area. And, they may fly around, and I may like to talk a little trash on the golf course, and seagulls may fly around above you on the beach and may take a little number two on you. So that's sort of how I got my name. I like to talk a little trash to everybody when I walk around, and someone came up with that. I think John Malinger or Colton Nose way back in the day, and they started calling me, think they were going to make me mad, and I embraced it. I said, that's what I do. I love it. So I love talking a little trash to the guys, no matter if they're older or younger. And it's to grow as of late with social media and all sorts of media, but I've embraced it.
You know, I like that. It's kind of like when a bird, it's happened to all of us, right? If a bird is going to take a dump on you, either it's the worst thing that could happen during the day or it's actually funny. It kind of just depends on the kind of mood you're in, right?
I try to take the dump and make it funny. There's obviously times where you can go over the top and it's not funny. I don't try to push those lines too much unless you're really pissing me off. But no, I'm just joking. But that's the nature of it, and that's sort of what the origin of the Seagull came from.
He is a PGA Tour pro, a friend of the program, four-time winner, 5 top 25s last season, a chairman or the chairman of the Players Advisory Council. Don't ever forget, a national champion at UNLV, the pride of Poway. Charlie Hoffman. Charlie, great to have you back. Really appreciate you. Thank you so much. Hope to see you out there soon.
Thanks. Can't wait for you guys to start watching us on some TV and competing again. Thanks for having me.
As the coronavirus continues to keep many of us in lockdown, there are more and more unbelievable stories that could only happen as a result of the pandemic, and they're still rolling in. Today, I could fill every one of your buckets with Rona absurdity. I will not do that. But I do have a couple of stories to share with you, starting with this unbelievable news item out of South Korea. A local soccer team partially filled in the empty seats in their stadium with sex dolls.
Sex with me.
FC Seoul apparently was not content to play their previously postponed championship game without fans. Never mind that if we could just get the games back, even without the fans, we'll take that. And it works. We saw what Dana White did, 3 events with UFC in Jacksonville in about a week. So it does work, but not for these folks. They needed people in the seats, but they couldn't get people in the seats. So instead, they went with a bunch of sex dolls. And they put jerseys on them, and they parked them in the stands. The only thing more absurd than having a bunch of life-size sex dolls in the background of a highly rated soccer game that families across the country were watching is the apology that the team then spit out. Quote, we sincerely apologize for causing deep concerns to the viewing fans. Our staff went through the confirmation process that they were not adult products several times. End quote. So their staff went through a confirmation process to make sure they were not sex dolls. They're not? Oh, all right. If they're not sex dolls, then why were the sex dolls holding up advertising signs for the sex doll company that manufactures them if they're not sex dolls? I'll tell you why. Because they were sex dolls. So why are you telling your fans that you thought they weren't? You didn't know? How could you not know? Look at them. Definitely sex dolls. Epic fail, FC Seoul. You better get busy on your sex doll confirmation process. Clearly it doesn't work. You can't make this stuff up. A South Korean soccer team put sex dolls in the seats, had them holding up signs for the sex doll company that made them, and then issued an apology saying that they went through the confirmation process several times and did not determine that those were sex dolls holding up signs from a sex doll manufacturer. But no, they're not sex dolls.
Sex with me.
Ordinarily, that would take the cake. Ordinarily, that would take the prize. But there's something even better. And the reason for that is this other story is a tale. It's a tale of lies. A tale of lies, deception, cover-ups, and one giant buck-toothed rat. If you lived in the United States for any part of the last 40 years, you are undoubtedly aware of the chain franchise Chuck E. Cheese. Chuck E. Cheese. For those of you who do not know, and is there anybody listening who doesn't? But if you don't, it's a birthday party destination for kids between the ages of 4 and 12. And really freaking weird. Normally when I say weird, weird is good. Not in this case. Inside you'll find an arcade, set of arcade games, and dance floors, and a ball pit, air hockey tables, and a gigantic rat mascot named Charles Entertainment Cheese, plus the world's worst cardboard pizza. The price of admission is not what you pay to be there. The price of admission is your insides. That you lose and give up as a result of their pizza. For the past 2 months, Chuck E. Cheese has been shut down and relegated to takeout orders only. One problem with that, nobody in the history of the universe would ever eat Chuck E. Cheese pizza outside the establishment. So when it came time for people to pick a place for pie, nobody was picking Chuck E. Cheese. Stands to reason. Either you're going for the mom and pop, New York style brick oven pizza, or you're going to go for the straight value play with the big three. The Hut, Domino's, or John's. Pizza Hut, Domino's, or Papa John's. If you absolutely hate your life and you've lost your will to live, you order Little Caesars. But under no circumstance do you pass up any other or every other option and willfully go to Chuck E. Cheese. You would never do that. You go there because there's some kid's party that you absolutely cannot get out of. Or you go there because you hate yourself and you hate your life. Turns out the brass at Charles E. Cheese even knew that. So they did what any struggling business would do. They went into survival mode. Turns out survival mode for Chuck E. Cheese is changing the name of the business, not telling anybody, and selling the same crappy pizza under a different name on Grubhub, DoorDash, and Uber Eats. This is amazing. For the last 2 months, customers across the U.S. have unknowingly been ordering Chuck E. Cheese pizza, thinking that it was something different. Something different called Pasquale's Pizza and Wings. It's incredible, right? Unfortunately for E. Cheese, a Grubhub customer in Philly blew the lid right off the entire scam. This customer noticed the address for Pasquale's was exactly the same address for their local Chuck E. Cheese. And after noticing that the pizza was the same too, this person texted their Grubhub driver and asked if the pie came from Chuck E. Cheese, to which the driver responded, yes, it did. Uh-oh! There's catfishing on the internet. And there is rat fishing in the pizza game because that giant rat just got caught rat fishing unknowing customers. And the story from Philly turned out to be the same story nationwide as all the other Pasquale's traced back to a local Chuck E. Cheese. Man, imagine knowing your pizza sucks so bad that you have to change the name of the restaurant just to get people to buy it. Then imagine going through with that plan, knowing that every address nationwide traces right back to your business and just crossing your fingers every day that you won't get caught. What? Like 612 Pasquale's, a place that nobody's ever heard of, just popped up overnight out of nowhere. Dang, like that is a hell of a rollout. Even Pasquale himself had to know that con would never fly. That freaking giant rat had to be thinking, let's just run this scam until somebody figures it out. And somebody will. But until then, let's jam as much provolone into our pockets as we can. Well, they knew all right, because they had an explanation already locked and loaded. In a statement provided to Food & Wine magazine, the giant adult rats at E. Cheese said, quote, "It's a different pizza that features a thicker crust and extra sauce, giving customers a more flavorful premium pizza experience," end quote. Freaking genius. Man, these rats are playing chess. Buffalo. Jake in Buffalo. What's going on, Jake? How are you?
Jim, thanks for the vine, brother!
Oh, wait, not everyone in Buffalo talks like they're a constipated pro wrestler. Yo, I actually called in to take a swipe at Kyle in Green Bay. You know, it's one thing to bust some chops and get on Twitter and say, you know, beef's got plenty of gravy, or say, you know, Nooch is burning more trees than a Brazilian paper company. But if you're getting really mean with it, that's just a bad move, bro. And for real, you know, I'm trying to be sympathetic, and I see him driving this hotel on wheels around and basically just hanging out with a bunch of dudes. And, you know, he's hanging out with so many dudes, I'm honestly waiting on him to post a selfie from J-Stu's dorm room. I mean, for real, I haven't seen someone surround themselves with this kind of sausage.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Yeah, Jake, I don't think I have to work that hard to figure out where you were going with that. Let's go to Texas. What's up, Johnny?
Jimmy, what's going on, brother?
Better. Not
too
much.
Man,
how about you?
Listen, dude, a very, very humble, I'm sorry for calling in. I know your name. It'll never happen again, bro. Listen, dude, I have been really having a good time on Twitter, getting to know some good clones, and especially getting hyped about Smack Off 26. But here recently, man, I've had some people come after me, and I want to go ahead and address those bros. Hey, Kyle in Green Bay, dude, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but there is like a global pandemic going on. Why are you taking roadies to go hang out with other clones? Are you that socially irresponsible that you don't give a crap about families and the people, you know, the cars you sleep in at the rest stops? Dude, keep your ass at home, dude. We don't need to see you shaking hands and drinking girly beer with other bros. And hey, by the way, clones, get off Wellesley in the 360. The bro and his wife just had a woman, had a baby. And, you know, it happens, man. If you've ever had any kids, you know you kind of have a little bit of baby weight that goes on and some sympathy eating. But Wells a good dude. Get off of him. Jim, last night, Reggie in the I Can't Breathe OC hit me up on Twitter and said that, I don't know, he was just taking a run at me. And I'm sitting here going, dude, you can't even get through a call because your lungs are shattered because you're so far up the BIC's butt. I mean, seriously, dude, just get off of me. Hey, Matt in Garden City or Garden View or, I don't know, Home Depot, Garden Center, why are you calling me fat, dude? Why are you saying I've got a fat face? Let me tell you something, Matt. I thought you were a good bro. Latino on Latino crime is not cool. So get off of me. So here's the deal, Matt. I got a full head of hair, bro. I got awesome blue eyes, and the ladies like me. You know why? Because I have...
That's not a good call. No.
Here's the deal, Johnny.
I don't like that call.
Now you're done. Johnny, that was way more hack-off than it was smack-off. So Toronto's been coming on of late. Sonny, let's try it again. How are you, Sonny?
Hey, Jim, what an honor, what a privilege. Look, I'm sorry about the last week that when we got disconnected, I was in my mom's basement. The reception wasn't that well. And congratulations, Jim, on the Hall of Fame, and congratulations on the fact that you managed to turn the most polite country, the people, against each other. Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you. You're welcome. I'm sorry. Look, I need to reply to the rest of Canada in regards to Toronto being called a butthole. I think the rest of Canada is just butthurt. Do they think they even have a professional sport, the CFL? Yeah, that's not going to count. Two teams with the same nickname, What was that all about? Our mayor smoked a crack pipe. How cool is that, right? Look, I hate Toronto too. It's too crowded. But Jim, that's my city. That's where my life started. I hate the Six, like I hate my ex-wife, but they're mine, and it's my job to defend them till the end of time. Only I can speak on my city and my ex-wife. I've earned that right. She used to call me a loser, hack, fat ass, sociopath. Back off, Canada. This is Toronto's clapback. And Jeff from BC, your pronunciation of the Habs made you sound privileged and douchey. And who cares about the Leafs? We just brought home the Larry B. Snatch it from 29 American teams. Know what I mean? Besides, what has the rest of Canada ever done? What have you won? Is the rest of Canada even open for business? Who cares? So irrelevant, COVID didn't even go there. The pandemic didn't even bother. The rest of Canada is our bitch. Call us Big Daddy. We're your father. Look, I love Canada, and I can say those things, but I'm not. Consider this a warning shot. And what up, my neighbors to the south? Keep the Six out your mouth. Yeah, we have milk in a bag, but you have cereal in a bag too. So we need each other. Let's try to get along, huh? Choo-choo.
Oh, you did not end that call like that, Sonny. Wow. Friend of this program, he is Ben Golliver. Ben, how have you been doing during the middle of this pandemic, Ben?
Well, you want the short version or the long version, right? I mean, I feel like that's the answer every time somebody asks that. I'm doing well, hanging in there, good health. My family's all good, and I hope the same for you too, Jim.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Ben. Me too, and I understand exactly what you're saying. There is a short answer, and there is a long answer. All right, so there is no NBA right now, though. But we did have The Last Dance. Overall, what did you make of the 10 episodes of The Last Dance?
Well, as a guy growing up, just completely indoctrinated sort of in the MJ fan cult, I thought it was awesome. It was a fun look back, a nostalgic look back. I saw a lot of players. I saw a lot of media members, maybe under the age of 30, who were learning some of the stories that we grew up on, and I thought that was great. You know, to me, I think it's important to remember how his fingerprints were all over this project, right? You know, we have to acknowledge that we're getting the story that Michael Jordan wants us to watch. And it's interesting what he included in that story and what he didn't. For example, he's willing to talk about some of the gambling stuff, some of the political drama, but he doesn't necessarily want to show us his family. He's not even necessarily taping his interviews at his own home. And so to me, I saw a guy who in retirement still very much cherishes his privacy, definitely still has parts of his personality that he doesn't want to show to us as a viewer, and a guy who obviously wants the conversation to stay on the court. Because when he was on the court, he was an absolute killer. And we saw him just, you know, mow down Isaiah Thomas, Magic Johnson, Clyde Drexler, Charles Barkley, Gary Payton, John Stockton, Karl Malone in order, you know, episode by episode. And, you know, it's an incredible career. And to me, I think he steps away from this, making his case. He's the greatest of all time. And in basketball circles, and he's not matched right now.
All right, so Ben, speaking of retirement, like at the end of the series, when Jordan's talking about the fact that he regrets that he didn't get the opportunity to win a seventh title, does it seem to you like he's settled and comfortable in retirement?
Oh, not at all. I mean, that's probably the, you know, he settles every score on the court, but this is one that he can't settle because it was out of his control. I mean, his whole plan of, hey, let's all take one-year deals, that sounds great when you're Michael Jordan and you're one-year deals for $30 million late in your career. Try to sell that idea to Scottie Pippen or some of those other role players who had never really had a big payday to that point. I mean, I think there were some very real problems facing that front office. And there's no question, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf and Jerry Krause deserve some serious blame for how they handled things going into that 97-98 season. I mean, they just, you know, didn't have everybody on the same page. You know, if Phil Jackson goes 82-0, he's going to be cast aside no matter what. I mean, to me, some of that public relations stuff is inexcusable, but there's no question. Guys were getting old. Dennis Rodman's going to, Detroit for a wrestling, a battle during the middle of the NBA Finals. He's on his last legs. Pippen's obviously wanting to get paid. I mean, to me, it was just a natural ending for that run to kind of come together at the same time. And Jordan just didn't plan it well enough. You know, he didn't see into the future. He didn't realize that some of those other guys were going to want to get taken care of financially. And it kind of all blew up in his face. But the bottom line is he went out with a bang in 98. I mean, that final shot, the entire sequence where he goes layup, steal from Karl Malone, and then final shot. To me, it's arguably the best minute of basketball in his career, and maybe the best minute that anybody's ever played.
We were talking to Ben Golliver. You know, one of the really interesting moments, I thought, Ben, in the series was the discussion of Scottie Pippen sitting out at the end of Game 3 of the 94 Conference Semis. Pippen said, quote, "It's one of those incidents where I wish it never happened, but if I had a chance to do it over again, I probably wouldn't change it," end quote. It's a really curious comment to me. What do you make of it?
Yeah, there was so much to take from the Scottie Pippen experience for this whole documentary. If I was him, I'd be watching this thing like, come on, man, I won 6 titles, and we're going to talk about my migraine, the time that I sit out with because of Kukoc, and then the fact that I had back spasms in 98. It's like all of his low moments got all this attention, right? To me, I think the big takeaway from that sit-down situation where Phil Jackson says, Tony, you're going to take the shot, Scottie's not, it would never happen in today's NBA, Jim. The superstars just have that level of clout. They would be able to overrule the play if they wanted. The coach would probably not try to defy them in the first place. They would just give them the ball. And look, if they ultimately did sit out, there would be a crazy media storm. Everyone would be freaking out. It would be much worse even than what Scottie Pippen faced in the 90s. And then after the fact, you know, if Pippen really felt snubbed by his organization in today's day and age, he could get his coach fired or he could demand a trade. And it's just those weren't things that were available to him back in the 90s. So I think that specific scene, but as well as the entire Pippen story where they're kind of dwelling on his low moments, it really made me feel sympathetic and, you know, a little bit sad for Scottie Pippen. And the ultimate number two guy, how often do we see NBA players these days willingly cede to an alpha dog for their entire prime like Scottie Pippen did? Certainly he benefited. You know, he has 6 titles to show for it, and he's still a very prominent NBA figure, considered one of the top 50 greatest players of all time, of course. But, you know, taking that number two role is not easy, especially when you realize you're one of the best players in the entire league.
You know, Ben, what I thought was really interesting was Scottie said, I had an opportunity to play with the best player ever. I had an opportunity to play for the best coach ever. We had the best general manager ever. I mean, obviously, Jerry Krause did not really fare well in this documentary at all. Now, he deserves a lot of credit for assembling the roster, and he's not able to defend himself in the series, but they did let that through. Mike let that through. He did say it. Scottie said he was the best GM ever, so I thought that was interesting in and of itself. Put that aside, how much blame do you think Krause deserves for situations with Phil Jackson and Scottie Pippen, among others?
Well, first thing on the greatest GM ever comment, I mean, to me, we need a lie detector version of this documentary, don't we? I mean, it's funny that Scottie's the one who says it. Michael never says anything along those lines, right? So we know where Michael really stands. And similarly, there's times where, you know, Jordan was saying things about Pippen like, oh, he had a migraine. You know, I had to understand in that moment he couldn't play. And I kind of wish we had the lie detector on Michael Jordan to hear what he really felt about some of those moments, given just how pivotal they were for the Bulls story. In terms of Krause's role, though, look, he did an amazing job building that roster. I mean, he really, you know, even getting Pippen in the first place, having the guts to go out and put a first-time coach like Phil Jackson into that role, you know, a seldom-known assistant coach, you know, to replace Doug Collins with him, even though they're already a successful team in the playoffs, that's a huge move. And not a lot of GMs today would have that kind of sway or have that you know, have that level of influence within their organization. But to me, it's like he does deserve a lot of the blame for the way that it fell apart, because everybody was unhappy. These were all champions. It should have just been a money machine. It should have been a title ring machine. He should have been going back to ownership and saying, look, we need to, you know, keep these guys together. We need to spend big to keep this group. We see it all the time in the modern NBA where owners are going deep in the luxury tax to keep together title teams. I mean, that's the sign of good ownership and good management, and he just wasn't able to do that. I mean, I think ultimately they cut corners. You know, they gave Jordan just enough help so that they could get across the finish line, and then the whole thing blew up in their face.
Ben Golliver is joining us. Ben is a critical thinker and a veteran journo. I'm curious about this. And you understand this, because I pose the question does not mean that I have the answer, know the answer, or even necessarily have an opinion. But in terms of the pizza, the poison pizza. You know, when you hear that story, and we've all heard the story now, 5 guys delivered the pizza, only one person ate the pizza, Mike ate the pizza. Does that sound legitimate to you, or does that smell fishy to you?
No, it definitely seems like a fish story, right? Where just the whole story gets a little bit bigger and bigger every time it gets told, and all of a sudden there's 5 guys delivering one pizza, and they're trying to look in to see if it's Michael Jordan, and it sounds like it's a scene out of Sopranos or something. Look, I don't know. I wasn't there. You know, certainly what we do know is Jordan was not right. And I've actually had food poisoning before, and I looked a lot like Jordan looked during that game. So whether it was food poisoning or hangover, like some people want to suggest, or whatever else, he was not, in very good shape. That's just a remarkable game, though, because those Jazz teams, to me, Jim, were really underrated by history. And I actually think they got a little bit snubbed in this documentary, too. I think they should have talked more about the power of that John Stockton-Karl Malone combination. Instead, they got caught up in all the Brian Russell trash talking and, oh, the fans are crazy in Utah and the food poisoning stuff. That was a really, really good, strong, tested, smart team that made back-to-back finals and kind of pushed Jordan right to the edge in that flu game. And then, again, he looks absolutely exhausted by the end of the 1998 finals, too. So for me, I think it's just another chapter of the Jordan lore. I'm not sure we're ever supposed to know what really happened, and maybe that makes it a little bit more magical.
I think you're right, Ben. And that was my point. I don't know exactly what happened. You know, we can raise any kind of objection or question, but the fact of the matter is the guy was wrecked. The guy was not right, and he went out there and had an amazing game. I also echo what you say about the Utah Jazz. Those were damn good teams, really good teams. Karl Malone was unbelievable. John Stockton was incredible. Together, they were unbelievable. Great, great coach in Jerry Sloan, I thought. That was tough. Those were really good teams. All right, so finally, what's your overall impression of Jordan coming out of this series? Do you see him or feel any differently about him coming out than you did going in?
No, I just think it's a deeper, a richer portrait. I mean, the same themes have been there since the 90s, right? All this guy cares about is winning. He's willing to win at all costs. He doesn't care if he runs over some teammates or his coaches or his general manager in the first place. Whatever it takes to get the job done. And I think ultimately, like, he looks like a product of his time, right? I think a lot of modern players are looking at Jordan and saying, if this guy called me the names that he's calling Scott Burrell, I wouldn't take it. I would be out. And I think the NBA culture and climate has changed pretty significantly. It's not like, all touchy-feely and kumbaya now. But I do think that some of the stuff that Jordan was doing on a regular basis in the 90s probably wouldn't fly in the modern NBA, if only because there'd be so much more scrutiny attached to them. They'd be dissected on Twitter and put on every NBA talk show and everything else. So I think from that standpoint, we do have a distancing effect from the Jordan era, from Jordan the person. But I think ultimately he stated his case very, very well. I don't know if you remember this, Jim. A few years ago, LeBron had an interview where he basically called himself the greatest of all time. He said, look, when I won that 2016 title, I felt like that made me the greatest. I think in that moment, LeBron told us that. And I think with this documentary, Jordan showed us that he feels like he's the greatest of all time. He never comes out and says it directly, but he's got Obama, he's got Justin Timberlake. He's got all these different people kind of weighing in on his influence and his fame. And that scene where they go to Paris and the front of the newspaper says, Michael Jordan is bigger than the Pope. It's like, okay. Now we really know what we're dealing with. This is a level of celebrity and fame that just no real modern athlete can kind of live up to right now. And to me, I think ultimately it was a very convincing case by him.
No, Ben, and to your point, it's a very good point. And to your point, if I'm not mistaken, did Mike not green light this finally right around the time that LeBron made that statement?
Right. And, it's funny. How long do you wait, right? What's the appropriate amount of time? Because when I'm watching him, bump into Leonardo DiCaprio in the hallway after the 1998 finals, it's like, how could this ever sit in a vault for 22 years? Somebody didn't want to put this scene out. It's just such incredible footage, right? But I think that wound up being a masterstroke. And I think, unfortunately, because of the coronavirus, their timing was perfect. I mean, the ratings were excellent. I think 5 or 6 million people for every single episode. I think from that standpoint, this whole project came together as probably as well as they could have hoped, especially considering the circumstances. But the guy is a competitor, right? I mean, look at how much he hated the idea that the media would put Clyde Drexler into the same sentence as him. Do you think he feels any differently when guys like us are saying Jordan or LeBron, LeBron or Jordan? I'm sure that stuff grinds his gears. And I think ultimately this project winds up, being this case for himself, right? This moment that traces his entire career, his many high moments, gives a little bit of his personality and lets him kind of answer all questions on all topics.
I just wonder. I wonder, like we watched Kobe in retirement and he seemed fulfilled and he had other things. I can only imagine what LeBron's going to be in retirement. Do you really think that LeBron's going to be grinding gears and running on that same fuel that Kobe was in retirement? No, I don't think so, right?
No, I hear you, man. Look, Jordan was great at basketball, but evolution, not really his thing, right? I mean, he definitely still...
That's a great line right there, Ben.
Those same... Like, Isaiah Thomas kills him today, just like Isaiah Thomas killed him in 1990. And You know, that's an admirable quality too, right? Like, he's not going to change for anybody. He is who he is. It's a little bit old school. It's a little bit traditional. But to me, I do respect it. I mean, he's still got the cigars. He's still got the scotch, you know, just like he wanted to, back in the 90s. I mean, I don't think that he has changed, you know, fundamentally, at least his public presentation. Now, people will say, you know, he's like this very doting grandfather now, right? And again, he enjoys his privacy. So he's got an entire private life that he's not letting us into. But I think from the public side, he knows what his image is, and he knows how to maintain it, you know, perfectly or immaculately. I mean, he's really worked on that for years and years and years. This guy is a media genius. I mean, you could see when he's going in front of those cameras night after night after night, he's not slipping up. He's saying exactly what's on his mind, and he's getting his points across.
Good night now!